one for being patient. All right. Again, those of you who have joined us today, welcome to today's Research to Practice webinar hosted by the SPRC Training Institute and the Federal Partners in Bullying Prevention. At this moment, again, we have 973 people connected to this webinar. I'm delighted to report that over 4,000 people registered to attend today's webinar from all 50 U.S. states, as well as from Puerto Rico, Barbados, Canada, Dubai, Brazil, Peru, Australia, and New Zealand. Clearly, the topic of today's webinar has generated a great deal of interest. Welcome to all of you. We are fortunate to have two well-respected experts with us today who will share findings related to the relationship of different bullying behaviors to suicidal thought behaviors and how to apply these findings to both preventing bullying behavior and preventing the possible psychological consequences of being involved in bullying as a victim, bully, or both. A number of people expressed a comment about today's webinar and asked if they could obtain bullying prevention and suicide prevention after the webinar. The answer is yes. Both presenters have listed additional resources available online and in print in their presentation slides. You can also find additional resources on the SPRC website and the website of our parent organization, the Education Development Center. For more information about suicide prevention, visit the SPRC website at www.sprc.org. There, you can browse our online library, learn about evidence-based programs and best practices, take free online courses, and listen to research practices in the past. Webinars on related topics have included suicide prevention among lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender youth, and suicide narratives in the news media. For more information about bullying prevention, feel free to visit the website of the Education Development Center at www.edc.org. There you can find information about EDC's Bullying Prevention and Research Institute, our current Bullying Prevention and Intervention Initiative, a joint project between EDC and Boston Public Schools, and the Children's Safety Network National Resource Center for Injury and Violence Prevention, which provides technical assistance and training to state health departments on a variety of injury and violence prevention topics, including bullying prevention. So on to today's webinar. Today, we are fortunate to have Dr. Anat Brunstein-Klomek and Dr. Catherine Bradshaw with us. First, we'll hear from Dr. Klomek. Dr. Klomek is a senior lecturer in the School of Psychology at the Interdisciplinary Center in Herzliya, Israel, and an adjunct associate research scientist in the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Columbia University, New York. Dr. Klomek received her Ph.D. in Child and Adolescent Clinical Psychology from Bar-Ilan University in Israel and completed a postdoctoral research fellowship in the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Columbia University. Dr. Klomek is the author of articles and book chapters on bullying, depression, and suicidality among adolescents. Since 2007, she has been the assistant editor of Archives of Suicide Research. Tiffany, if you could please unmute Dr. Klomek's line. Dr. Klomek, please go ahead.
Hello, everybody. I'm delighted to be here and present on this very important topic. And what I'm going to present today is the relationship between bullying and suicide prevention. I'm going to see, do I have the control? Okay, thank you. So I am going to talk about bullying, suicidal ideation, and suicide behavior among adolescents, and I want to thank the people which I've closely worked with, both at Columbia, first and foremost Madeline Gould, and other fellow collaborators, both at Columbia and in Finland, which you will see in this slide. And I will start my talk with defining what we're talking about. So although there are many definitions for bullying behavior and they vary, most agree that bullying behavior involves an attack or intimidation with an intention to cause fear or harm to the other. And there is usually an imbalance of power between the bully and the victim, which makes it hard for the victim to defend himself. We are also talking about a very important feature, that the bullying is a repeated type of behavior. It's repeated attacks or intimidation between the same children over time. To the next slide, I will present the different types of bullying. And we usually define these types by direct and indirect types. And when we talk about direct types, we consider physical bullying, like hitting, kicking, verbal bullying, like name calling, and other types of more indirect, which are social exclusion, spreading rumors, and the newest and very popular type now, which is cyberbullying, that we see in social networks, texting, emails, and different websites and chats. So a little bit about the characteristics of cyberbullying, and I will talk not much about the association of cyberbullying with suicidality, because there's very little research about that. Most of the research we have on bullying and suicidality is for the traditional bullying. But the characteristics of cyberbullying is basically that it is very difficult to escape from cyberbullying, because cyberbullying could be 24 hours, 7 days a week. There's a large potential audience on the social networks. The cyberbully is usually anonymous, and he might be or she might be less aware of the consequences of his or her behaviors, and there are fewer opportunities for empathy and remorse. When we talk about the youth who are involved in bullying, we usually consider four groups, and we talk about the bullies, the attackers, the perpetrators, we talk about the victims, and we talk about another third group, which are both bullies and victims. The fourth group, which I will not say much about today, again, because we don't know much about the association of the bystanders, those who see the bullying, and we don't know much about the association of the bystanders with suicidality, so I'll emphasize more on the first three groups. But that's not because the bystanders are not important. They are very important. We just don't know enough yet. Okay, a few points which are very important for me to highlight before I go into the actual data and what the research is telling us. We have all to be very aware that bullying is not part of normal growing up. Bullying should not be tolerated, and bullying is really associated with serious adverse psychological outcomes. When I go through and want to define a little bit about the suicide world, and we usually look into the suicide world in children, adolescents, and adults, and we talk about suicidal ideation, which is thoughts about suicide. We talk about suicidal behavior, which are behaviors that are self-directed, non-fatal, and result in some kind of injury or a potential for injury. And examples for these are suicide attempts, which are very frequent in adolescents, and preparatory acts. And we also talk about, of course, suicide, which is a death caused by self-directed injurious behaviors with an intent to die. And in terms of the extent of the problem, what we know from CDC recent data is that in a typical 12-month period, nearly 14% of American high school students seriously considered suicide. Almost 11% made plans about how they will end their lives, and 6% actually attempted suicide. We also know that suicide is the third leading cause of death among adolescents 12 to 18 years old, which is very concerning and, of course, makes it a public health issue. Probably the take-home message from my presentation is starting right now. There is a very complex relationship between bullying and suicidality. What we frequently hear in the media and read about in the newspaper is that there's some kind of typical message that bullying causes suicide. But actually, this does not tell the full story. And it's much more complicated than that because we know suicide risk may be substantially mediated by a lot of other factors. And we have a lot of studies talking about these factors, which include psychopathology, which includes suicides in the family, which includes substance abuse, and much more that you can read about from the reference list that I've added at the end of the presentation. I want to tell you a little bit about the studies that we've been doing at Columbia with New York State schools. And what we wanted to see in these cross-sectional studies was, first of all, the prevalence of bullying behavior both in and out of school. And we wanted to look into the association of bullying behavior with depression, suicidal ideation, and suicide attempts by gender. We also wanted to examine the co-occurrence of being both a bully and a victim, which was the third group I referred to. So the study was with adolescents ages 13 to 19 in six schools in New York State between 02 and 04. And what we did was ask these children general questions about how often were they bullied at school, bullied away from school, and bullied others in school and away from school in the last 4 weeks. We also asked them specific types of victimizations that they were victimized by, and these included physical bullying, indirect bullying of spreading rumors, making social jokes, and using email and internet to be mean to them. And what you see on the right-hand side is basically the frequency that they were asked to rank the bullying behavior. So the first two were considered the infrequent involvement, and the last three to four times in the last 4 weeks until most days in the last 4 weeks were considered the frequent involvement in the behavior. And what we found in terms of prevalence is that bullying is, as we thought before, is a very frequent behavior. And this first slide shows the prevalence of the frequent bullying involvement. And you see the numbers and the differences between the males and females, both in school, which is on the left-hand side, and out of school, which is on the right-hand side. And if I add to this the next slide, it will jump in the infrequent involvement. So when we include the infrequent involvement, we see the numbers really jumping high to very high percentages of the kids that are involved in bullying behavior, both as a victim in school and as a bully in school. If I just take as an example the boys in the in-school bullying, we're talking about 31% of the boys which are involved as bullies in school. Jumping to the next slide. This slide will show the differences in the gender in the frequent victimization. And what we see is that there are differences between males and females. So for some types of victimization, males are more involved, and for others, females are more involved. And you can see, of course, the physical is more frequent among the males. And when we talk about the sexual comments, it's the females which are predominant. And what we found basically in terms of the gender differences, which is very interesting, is that there appears to be a gender difference associated with the frequency of involvement in bullying, either as a bully or a victim, and adverse psychological outcomes. So in females, it's both the infrequent and frequent involvement, which is associated with adverse outcomes, whereas in the males, it's mainly the frequent involvement, which is associated with the adverse outcomes. And here we refer to it as what we call the gender paradox, that females, which are less likely to be bullies in terms of the frequencies of involvement, when they are involved, when the females are involved as bullies, they have a much more severe impairment than the males, which are involved. Two very important points from these cross-sectional studies. One, it's bullying others and not only being victimized, which is associated with depression, suicidal ideation, and suicide attempts. For years, we knew about the victims, but more and more we're finding that it's also the bullies which are very concerning, and that the strongest association between the involvement in bullying and depression, ideation, and attempts is among those who are both the bullies and the victims. I want to talk about the limitations of these cross-sectional studies, because it is very important to examine these studies while considering the limitations. Bullying experience and suicidal ideation and behavior in these cross-sectional studies are measured at the same time and often with self-reports. So even when we find that these are statistically correlated, this does not necessarily infer causality. We cannot talk about causality in cross-sectional studies because there might be mediating variables, and we don't know, for example, maybe bullying leads to depression, which then leads to suicidal ideation. And another option may be that there are some kind of mental health problems or other community, family, social risk factors that could then lead for the risk of bullying and subsequent suicidal ideation and behavior. So we have to be very careful when we interpret these cross-sectional studies. And these limitations basically led us to look at the association between bullying and suicide ideation and behavior in a longitudinal way. So we did a study with the same sample in New York, and we had three groups of high school students at onset. We had a group who were frequently involved in bullying but had no depression or suicidal ideation. We had a group who were frequently involved in bullying experience and had depression, suicidal ideation, and suicide behavior during high school. And the third group, which had depression, suicidal ideation, or suicidal behavior, which are risk factors for future suicide, but were not involved in bullying. And interestingly, what we found is that students who only reported bullying behavior, either as bullies, victims, or both, didn't develop later depression, suicidal ideation, or suicide attempts, and had fewer psychiatric problems compared to those who were identified as at risk for suicide, which had depression or ideation. We also found that students who reported bullying experience and depression, ideation, and behavior were more impaired 4 years later. So it's something about both the bullying and the other comorbidities of depression, ideation, or suicidal behavior that put them to be more impaired for the 4 years later. In addition to the U.S. studies, I was lucky enough to be part of a Finnish study which had longitudinal data from age 8. So the bullying behavior here is at age 8, and we were able to follow them up until age 25. At age 18, we were able to follow up the males in the sample because they have a military call-up in Finland, and at age 25, we were able to follow up those who are involved in bullying behavior, both boys and girls. And in this study, what we found is that for suicidal ideation, once we controlled among the males, remember this is only males, among the males, once we controlled for baseline depression, meaning for the depression when they were 8 years old, the bullying behavior was no longer associated with suicidal ideation. When we looked at age 25 at both genders, and when we looked at the boys at age 25, what we found is that frequent bullying and victimization were associated with later suicide attempts and completed suicide, but that didn't remain significant when we controlled for conduct and depression symptoms, meaning that once psychopathology was controlled for, bullying no longer predicted suicide attempts and completed suicide. Again, the message is, or may be, that it is the bullying behavior and the psychopathology that puts the kids at risk for future suicide attempts and completed suicide. Among the girls, however, the picture is a little different. And what you see in the next slide with the girls is that the girls who were involved in bullying at age 8, those who were frequently victimized, it put them at risk for later suicidal behavior regardless of the childhood psychopathology. So frequent victimization was associated with later attempts and completed suicide even after we controlled for the psychopathology of conduct and depression symptoms. And why are we finding these discrepancies between studies? And obviously, these are just some of our studies, and there are a lot of studies with a lot of discrepancies out in the field. And some of the explanations for these discrepancies may be, as I tried to show, that there are differences between correlation and longitudinal studies. Other differences may be because different studies look into different ages. Different studies define bullying in different ways. We know experience in bullying can really vary by the type of bullying, by the frequency, the duration, the intensity. We also know that different studies assess bullying in different ways. We know the Korean study look into peer nomination. Our U.S. study look into self-report. So there are really different ways to assess bullying. And we also, the different researchers in the field, look into different outcomes. Some examine suicidal ideation, either severe or any ideation. Others look into suicidal behavior. And another difference between studies is among those who control or not control for baseline psychopathology. I want to conclude with two slides that probably the first is that there is really a complex relationship between bullying and the risk of ideation and behavior. So what we get from the media that bullying causes suicide is not necessarily the exact picture. There is a very complicated relationship between the two phenomena. We also know that both bullying and victimization puts the adolescent at risk, but that's true especially when other psychopathology is present. So it's not only the victims. We should be concerned for the bullies, and we probably should be mostly concerned for those who are both bullies and victims, but we should be more and more concerned when psychopathology is present. Because it's not necessarily the bullying per se. There are really a lot of mediating variables that are very important to consider, because we know from a lot of research which has been done in a lot of years that suicidal ideation and behavior is usually not attributed to just one event or one factor. It's a very complex phenomena. Other conclusions that we can draw from our study and a lot of good others is that the groups which are involved in bullying behavior are really different groups, and we should consider these differences between the bullies, the victims, and those who are bully victims. And as I said, the bully victims are most concerning for most of the studies which assess them. And it is usually the frequent involvement that is most concerning to us, but we have to remember here that infrequent involvement is also concerning. None of us would want ourselves or our kids or the ones we love to be involved infrequently. So although we're talking and emphasizing about frequent involvement, we want to prevent the infrequent involvement and not tolerate any bullying at all, because we have to remember it can lead to adverse events. And that each gender has a markedly different risk profile. And at least from the Finnish data, girls may be more at risk of adverse psychological outcomes than boys. And maybe what this might say is that students which are involved in frequent bullying should be screened for suicidal ideation and behavior. And we definitely need more longitudinal studies to talk about causality and to establish causality in this field. So thank you very much, and we do have a list of references at the end that I hope will be helpful, and these are my emails, so feel free if anybody has a question or wants any of the references, I'll be happy to send them. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kromek. We'll now pause for some questions for Dr. Kromek. As a reminder, please type any questions you would like to ask into the question pane on your screen. Dr. Kromek, I see that we have a few questions for you, and one person was wondering how you controlled the answers from the youth that participated in the studies, because some bullies do not believe that they are actual perpetrators.
Right. Well, I think that's a limitation in all the studies that look into self-report. It's obviously a limitation when we ask the kids and we know that some of them are not aware. But that would be true for any study that looks into self-report with this field. So we had no control. I mean, for the U.S. data, it was only self-report. What we did in the Finnish data is we pulled together both parent report, teacher report, and the kids report. So there we had more flexibility. I know what the Korean or Dr. Kim has been doing is doing peer nomination, which could probably be a better control of the awareness of the kids. So they have the peers nominate who is involved as a bully.
Thank you. We have another question. Could you briefly explain the adverse outcomes that are mentioned for girls with any involvement in bullying?
Yes. If we're talking, that could probably be in general, but in girls, what we're basically seeing from various research, and not just ours, that those who are victimized, we see a lot of depression, internalizing disorders like depression, anxiety, low self-esteem, a lot of physical complaints. It could be headaches, stomach aches, and we see a decrease in academic functioning. In terms of the bullies, and that's the girls, we see a lot of antisocial behavior. We see aggressiveness. We see substance abuse, alcohol use. So that would probably most of the main adverse outcomes.
Thank you. And another question is, what is your meaning or your definition when you use the term bully victim?
Bully victim means those who are both bullying others and being a victim. And nowadays we talk about cyber bully victims and we talk about traditional bully victims. So it's basically those who are both bullying others and being victimized by others. And it could start by being a victim and then becoming a bully, and it could start by being a bully and then being victimized by others. And there are research, different studies showing the different, but we know from studies that this group is very concerning. They're at risk for adverse outcomes. They're at highest risk for depression. So this group is really a red flag for clinicians and for people working with children and adolescents.
Great. And one last question. Does the study in the New York schools take into consideration the possibility that students are answering without a clear understanding of what the definition of bullying is?
What we do is we give a definition of bullying. I know not all studies and not all researchers do that, but we do give a definition of bullying. So if you can look, at the paper. We have a paper in American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, and you can see the definition that we give. We usually use the Olvius definition, but different researchers do. So that's how we deal with that.
Thank you so much, Dr. Klomek. And now I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Catherine Bradshaw. Dr. Bradshaw is a developmental psychologist and youth violence prevention researcher. She is an associate professor in the Department of Mental Health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and has a joint appointment in the Johns Hopkins School of Education. She is a deputy director of the Johns Hopkins Center for the Prevention of Youth Violence and the co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Prevention and Early Intervention. She holds a doctorate in developmental psychology from Cornell University and a master's in counseling and guidance from the University of Georgia. Her primary research interests focus on the development of aggressive behavior and school-based prevention. She collaborates on research projects examining bullying and school climate, the development of aggressive and problem behaviors, effects of exposure to violence, peer victimization, and environmental stress on children, and the design, evaluation, and implementation of evidence-based prevention programs in schools. Dr. Bradshaw also works with the Maryland State Department of Education and several school districts to support the development and implementation of programs and policies to prevent bullying and school violence and to foster safe and supportive learning environments. Dr. Bradshaw, please unmute your phone and you may begin.
Great. Well, thank you so much for inviting me here today to talk about best practices related to the integration of bullying and suicide prevention efforts. In today's talk, I'm going to cover three core elements. The first is common elements of effective school-based prevention programs. I'm not sure that this is advancing just yet, so... If we could advance the slide, Oh, there we go. Perfect. Thank you. So in terms of today's talk, I'm going to cover three core elements. One is some common features of effective school-based bullying prevention programs that also overlap a bit with some of the work around suicide prevention. I'll address some of the common risk factors between bullying and suicide prevention, because I think there's some emerging interest in this area and some potential evidence that would suggest that we can try to address both forms of violence using some common approaches. And then I'll conclude by some ways to integrate those two approaches into a more comprehensive prevention initiative within the school. I'm going to begin with a brief review of the tiered approach to prevention that is common in the public health area. My current position is in a school of public health at Johns Hopkins, and so I often apply this lens, which is probably pretty familiar to many of you in the audience here who are engaged in prevention across several different areas. Clearly, many of you are involved in suicide prevention or perhaps bullying prevention, but those working in violence or obesity prevention would probably employ a similar type of approach that has been recommended by the Institute of Medicine and several of the federal agencies, including the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. This is also very similar to some approaches used in education that fall under the heading of response to intervention or positive behavioral interventions and supports, where there's a tiered approach. And that first tier is typically the universal system, and it's depicted in that triangle up on the right-hand side under the green. These are the types of supports that are intended to affect all students or all individuals within a particular population, in our case, thinking about bullying and suicide prevention among youth, a school setting that would relate to everyone in the school building. But typically, we see that perhaps about 80% of individuals might respond to these universal types of prevention approaches. And so layered onto that, we have a series of selected interventions that might meet the needs of about 10 to 15% of individuals. This subgroup is individuals that might be at risk for involvement in bullying or suicide, as it were, in this case. And the third layer are these indicated interventions. And so these are for youth that are already showing early signs of problem behavior and would include about 5 to 10% of the population that need these more intensive types of supports. So when thinking about bullying prevention, an example of a universal approach would include a social-emotional learning curriculum that is implemented for everyone in the school, for all students. And quite often we recommend the use of class time to discuss bullying is recommended as part of the OVEAS bullying prevention program, and using lessons to foster skills and competencies, effective communication and strategies. So those would be examples of universal strategies, as would classroom management. Effective classroom management has been shown to promote a positive school climate and reduced rates of bullying. At the second tier, there would be selective interventions, and this might include more intensive social skill training for smaller groups of youth that are at risk for becoming involved in bullying. And finally, at the indicated level, or this tier three, it may include more intensive supports or programs tailored to meet the needs of students identified as a bully or as a victim, as well as to meet the needs of their family. Moving on to the next slide here, talk a little bit about what we've learned in terms of school-wide approaches to bullying prevention. There are a series of elements that are highlighted here. Many of these show up in some of the evidence-based models, such as the OVEAS bullying prevention, and are summarized in greater detail in the StopBullying.gov website. I will refer you onto those resources if you're interested in hearing more about these approaches. But just briefly, one that is really recommended for all contexts, whether it be a school or an after-school setting, would be to establish clear expectations for positive behavior across all contexts, whether they be at the school or after school or even at home. Establishing and implementing clear anti-bullying policies. Nearly all states now have developed anti-bullying legislation, specifically addressing issues of bullying that are different from harassment, although some states do combine the two. However, just because you have a bullying policy doesn't mean that the staff are necessarily aware of that. We recently conducted a study in Maryland where we found that despite having a policy on the books for about 6 years now, about 83% of staff thought were aware that the state had a bullying policy, and these are school staff who purportedly had been trained. In fact, we found that only 69% of the staff surveyed in this large statewide initiative had actually received training on the state's policy. So clearly, having a policy doesn't necessarily mean that you can just assume that the information gets out. You need to have direct training that involves all staff in the school building. And that includes education support professionals, so bus drivers, cafeteria workers, as well as classroom-based teachers. Teachers need to be trained how to implement effective classroom management strategies and how to respond to bullying when they see it. Data is critical, and this comes up as we talk about suicide prevention as well, but data is needed to inform things like surveillance and identifying hotspots in the school where bullying might be occurring, but also to be able to monitor the impact of intervention strategies that are implemented. Thinking about different populations that are involved, moving to the next slide here, we want to involve families and communities in these efforts because the role of bullying prevention should not fall solely on the schools, but we want to be sure that families are involved in these efforts as well as our communities. And so training opportunities need to be provided for parents about how to respond. There's a recent study by one of my colleagues, Sarah Lindstrom Johnson, that examined parent-child conversations about bullying. And the research indicated that parents were often giving their kids mixed messages about how to respond to bullying. They were telling their kids, don't fight, don't bully, but if somebody bullies you, you better stand up for yourself. And in many cases, they were encouraging their kids to fight back. So I think this is an area that we really need to do more research as to how we can promote positive conversations between parents and children that prevent bullying rather than escalate the situation. We also need to have opportunities for schools to be able to connect with families and provide open communication around the issue of bullying. We have a recent study that shows the school climate actually is a factor that influences parents' willingness to reach out to the school and talk to them when they have concerns about bullying among their children. We also need to have clear and strategies that parents can get actively involved in bullying prevention within the school, whether they be a member of a school climate promotion team or a bullying prevention team. There are also strategies to involve community members, and this often includes social marketing campaigns that can happen on a community level or within a neighborhood that increase awareness about the prevalence of bullying as well as common risk factors and what to do when they see bullying. There are some strategies that are summarized on the stopbullying.gov webpage. They have a really nice toolkit that communities can use and adapt for their own context that helps share these messages around bullying prevention and help them communicate with a variety of different audiences, including families and community members. Also, the American Academy of Pediatrics has gotten really involved in strategies to help doctors and other health in the health profession become more aware of signs and symptoms of bullying to ask about that in their checkups that they do with kids. Moving on to the next slide, there are some non-recommended approaches that are important to keep in mind. Some of these, again, have been summarized on the Stop Bullying website, and I highlight some of the work that Sue Limber and colleagues have done with HRSA around this issue. But the first, which is often kind of a challenging one for some people to understand, is the role of peer mediation or peer-led conflict resolution approaches. Quite often, these strategies are used to try to address issues around fighting or other forms of youth violence that schools might face. However, we're cautious about recommending these strategies in a situation of bullying for a couple of reasons. One is that in a situation of a conflict, it's very different than a situation of bullying, which is more like an abuse situation where there is that power differential, as we heard about in the previous presentation. And putting a youth who's been victimized across the table from a youth who's been perpetrating the bullying can actually be very hurtful and very damaging and can even reinforce that power differential between the two. So we're very cautious and recommend schools not use peer mediation or peer conflict strategies because they may actually emphasize this power difference and serve as further victimization. And thinking of other kinds of peer-facilitated programs, there are some concerns that have emerged in a variety of different studies about potential for deviance training when you are pairing up youth together with the intent of trying to reduce aggressive and disruptive behavior. Sometimes there can be negative effects, actually making the kids' behavior worse as a result of deviance training or modeling. And certainly those aren't intended outcomes by the adults that are involved. This tends to be a bit more common in programs that may not be very well supervised and that are youth-led. Brief assemblies are also one strategy that we certainly recognize. The intent here is to increase awareness of the issue of bullying, but generally they tend to have limited impacts in terms of actual changing behavior. Sometimes you can even see a little bit of a burst in terms of reports of kids' rates of bullying because they have become aware, but then there isn't really much follow-up as a result of those assemblies, and so they typically aren't a good use of resources for being able to sustain long-term outcomes. Zero-tolerance policies that mandate suspensions. There's been a lot of work done on this area in terms of more general strategy for addressing issues of school violence, but there's also been interest in this around bullying prevention. The American Psychological Association did a pretty comprehensive review in 2008. More recently, Child Trends prepared a white paper reviewing the research in this area, and both similarly concluded that zero-tolerance policies either have no effects on issues related to youth violence and bullying, but they may actually even increase the rates of bullying because some adults or other youth might be less inclined to report bullying out of fears that the policy might be particularly harsh or punitive. And generally, they don't provide an opportunity for behavior change. When we heard even from the first presentation today that youth that are perpetrators of bullying also have mental health concerns or social-emotional problems that typically aren't addressed by just being suspended or kicked out of school. Moving on to the next slide, we're going to shift over and talking about what does work. And there is some good news here in terms of some of the meta-analyses that have been conducted, and that would be a review of different evidence-based interventions. And while some of the findings have been a bit mixed, there is some good news as it relates to some of the whole school types of approaches and some of the multi-component programs. In general, there was a study that was recently conducted by David Farrington and his colleague where they reviewed 53 different rigorous evaluations and randomized trials. Although two-thirds of these studies were conducted outside of the U.S. and about a third of the programs were conducted were similar or inspired by the work of Dan Olveus, generally we can glean some conclusions from this research showing that the prevention programs generally resulted in about a 20 to 23% reduction in the perpetration of bullying, and the effects were a little bit lower for victimization. The reductions there were about 17 to 20% reductions in victimization associated with these programs. The authors of the meta-analysis did conclude that the Olveus program, which I'll briefly mention in the next slides, was one of the programs that stood out above the others as being one that had the most promising effects in their review. But there are challenges regardless of which program is selected. We need to learn more about what works for whom and under what circumstances, because no one program is going to be the answer for all schools or for all communities. We really need to understand certain contextual factors that might influence the implementation of programs or the integrity with which the program is able to be implemented. No single program is going to meet everybody's needs, and schools really need to have sufficient buy-in and commitment to a long-term implementation or sustainability of the program rather than a quick changeover of different strategies on a regular basis. Moving to the next slide, I'll highlight just a couple of evidence-based programs. The first is the Olveus Bullying Prevention Program, which I mentioned was identified through the meta-analysis as one of the more effective. It has been one that's also been most rigorously studied within the U.S. and abroad. It is a multi-component program that addresses the issue of bullying through school-wide strategies. It includes classroom activities and meetings, as well opportunities for the students to talk with adults about the issue of bullying. It also includes targeted interventions for those who are involved using that three-tiered logic that I had mentioned before, and that there are activities to increase community and family involvement. The program has been tested on middle school youth, although there are some schools at the high school level that have been using it. Don't believe it's been tested as rigorously at that level, and so that's kind of a newer area at the high school. But generally speaking, the OVAIS model is one of the first to come to mind when we think about evidence-based approaches for bullying prevention. The next slide is the Steps to Respect program and is put together by the Committee for Children. If we can advance to the next slide. Thank you. So this is another multi-component program that addresses the issue of bullying school-wide. It includes activities for parents and classroom lessons, and there are also pull-out interventions for youth that are involved in bullying that are typically facilitated by the counselors or someone with mental health training in the school. There have been studies in the U.S., including one that just recently came out by Brown and colleagues, that do report positive impacts of the Steps to Respect program with regard to bullying behaviors as well as attitudes and improvements in the school climate. So that's another program. This program is used on the elementary school level, and typically in grades 3 through 6. And you can learn more information about that through the Committee for Children website if you're interested in getting more familiar with the research in that area. And the next slide summarizes some of the other evidence-based programs that come more generally out of the area of violence prevention. One thing I'm always a proponent of is it doesn't have to have the word bullying prevention in the title to address some of these risk factors for bullying. In fact, we have some data from other rigorous studies that have documented significant impacts on bullying and bullying-related behaviors. One of those is the Promoting Alternative Thinking Strategies, a social-emotional learning curriculum developed by Mark Greenberg and his colleagues. Another program that's similar in focus but called Second Step that's developed by Committee for Children. Coping Power is one of those indicated programs and is developed by John Lockman, also has data showing significant impacts on aggressive behavior. That includes a parent component as well, and they have documented outcomes with regarding bullying behavior and cutting down on that. The Good Behavior Game is a classroom management strategy typically used in elementary school, and there have been some longitudinal studies spanning over 20 years documenting significant impacts of this program on a range of outcomes, including aggressive violent behavior, substance abuse, some positive outcomes related to academic achievement and high school completion, but there are proximal impacts on bullying behavior as well. And this is a pretty modest intervention with regard to its ease of implementation. It's pretty easy to implement, and the outcomes are really pretty positive. I know SAMHSA has been involved in some dissemination efforts related to the Good Behavior Game. And I'll return to this in a few minutes when I talk about some positive outcomes for suicide ideation as well. And finally, a program kind of newer as it relates to some of the violence prevention work, but a increasingly popular program called Positive Behavioral Interventions and Supports. We actually have a paper coming out, I think later this week, from Archives of Pediatric and Adolescent Medicine that summarized some findings from a trial of PBIS documenting significant impacts on both victimization as well as perpetration of bullying as reported by teachers. So there's some resources down at the bottom there that you can check out for more information on these programs. But what's important for us to keep in mind is that we should be integrating these efforts together, because doing more doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to produce better outcomes. In fact, there's research by Denise and Gary Godfredson, although it was conducted back in the early 2000, we really do think that there's still a common approach that thinking that you're doing more and more programs is going to generate better outcomes for youth. But rather, we see that that leads to a lot of burnout and program fatigue among the staff. They often get overwhelmed and confused about implementing multiple programs if they're not connected, and that there's typically limited sustainability of these initiatives. And that's why we recommend that schools have more of a comprehensive approach where they try to integrate interventions, and using that three-tier public health framework is one way to do that, where you can connect in a school-wide piece with more selected and indicated interventions that address different levels of need. The next slide, we'll talk a little bit more about some of these strategies related to integration and some common prevention strategies that overlay both bullying as well as suicide prevention. Both the evidence-based approaches within suicide prevention as well as bullying acknowledge the importance of the school environment and often address issues around connectedness and positive school climate. Both approaches recognize the importance of family outreach and helping parents become more aware of risk and protective factors, the role of data in identifying students, and the importance of linking students with more intensive services. So those are some commonalities between bullying and suicide prevention approaches. The next slide talks about some of the overlap and the risk and protective factors for bullying and suicide. As we heard from the first presentation, there is some overlap, and I just wanted to hone in on those because I think this is one area that provides support for our integrated approach for addressing both suicide and bullying prevention simultaneously. So, for example, as we heard in the first presentation, a common risk factor for involvement in bullying as well as involvement in suicide are depression and anxiety, or what we refer to as internalizing symptoms. Similarly, emotion regulation and poor impulse control are also risk factors, particularly among youth that have that bully victim prototype where they are involved in bullying as both a perpetrator as well as a victim. But there are also common protective factors related involved in bullying and suicide, including youth's report of connectedness both to the school as well as to their peer group or their family environment, the social support that's available, and strategies that can help integrate them and reduce social isolation. In the next slide, talks about some strategies that can be employed to address these common risk factors. So it's important for schools to and communities to acknowledge the overlap between these two and help identify youth that might be simultaneously at risk for bullying as well as suicide. Data is very important in that process, and collecting information through screening can be one way of addressing this. But there are also some challenges associated with screening within a school setting that are important for us to keep in mind, especially when we come to bullying prevention, because quite often we're using anonymous surveys as a way of collecting data, and that may not be as instructive when we're trying to identify students who might be at risk for suicide. But both suicide and bullying prevention can be used in a systematic or a synergistic type of way. As I had referenced before, the good behavior game is one strategy that is largely a classroom management approach, but it aims to address, we have data indicating that it increases impulse control and improves group cohesion among students in the classroom. And then thus, we're very pleased to see some data from Holly Wilcox that documented there were significant reductions in suicide ideation, and some earlier work by Nick Iolongo and colleagues that documented significant reductions in bullying. So this is just one example, and I hope there'll be more that studies coming forth that will both simultaneously address issues around suicide ideation as well as bullying. So that way we can build a stronger evidence base in this area. The next slide. We talk about some of the shared features between suicide and bullying prevention. Policies and procedures are critical, and this is very important as we talk about staff training, both in the area of bullying as well as suicide prevention. There's some good materials coming out from SAMHSA around policies and procedures that schools should really take a look at to try to address, make sure that they have adequate procedures in place for linking youth with community resources as well as strategies for screening. Creating a culture that promotes connectedness, this is a big push, especially at the Centers for Disease Control, as one of their recent documents summarizes some of the research around the issue of connectedness and how that can both discourage issues involving bullying as well as promote more positive outcomes for youth who might be at risk for involvement in suicide or at risk for suicide. Educating parents is also a shared feature across the two approaches, helping parents recognize risk factors for both bullying and suicide and how to respond when they become aware that their child's at risk. And supervision is also critical. We tend to think of this more so with regard to bullying prevention, but this is also essential for suicide prevention because we want to make sure we limit youth's access to different instruments of harm that could be used both for self-inflicted injury as well as harm to others. The next slide. Talk about a couple of different action steps here is the wrap-up, where schools can go in terms of developing a synergy between bullying and suicide prevention. One is starting early. We know from decades of research around violence prevention that violent behavior has an early onset, and that could be anywhere from ages 3 to 5, often has a more intractable trajectory, and that can be more challenging to break if in adolescence and early adulthood if the intervention isn't developmentally appropriate. So we want to make sure that people are aware of the signs and symptoms of bullying, and that can begin very early on, even research showing that early precursors of bullying behavior can emerge as early as ages 3 or 4, and that's also true of aggressive and violent behavior. And that's often at an age before we typically start thinking about bullying, because the peak in bullying behavior is generally during the middle school years or early adolescent years. But also that is well before the early signs of suicide. But if we're able to prevent and identify some of these early risk factors and develop tailored interventions to meet the needs, we might be able to prevent the onset of suicide, like we saw in the example of the good behavior game. Preventing bullying among younger children can have significant benefits, not only on bullying, but on a range of social-emotional behavioral outcomes, especially if a social-emotional learning curriculum is used, as some of the research from Joe Durlach and colleagues has summarized, demonstrating significant impacts on academic as well as behavioral outcomes for social-emotional learning curricula. We also need to assess both the perpetrators and victims of bullying for risk factors associated with suicide. I think most people tend to just think about the victims of bullying as being at risk, but as we heard from Dr. Klomak's presentation, this can also be true for youth who are perpetrators. A second action step relates to using this comprehensive approach that addresses the youth, especially youth that have a profile which would suggest mental health problems, including depression, addressing the school context, reaching out to the family, and including the community, connecting up youth at risk with community-based resources. The next slide talks a bit more about the role of bystanders in this process. And bystander, as was briefly mentioned in the first presentation, is a big emphasis in some of the work on bullying prevention, whereby peers are often more aware of bullying behavior than the adults are in the environment. And this generally speaks to the disconnect between what you see and what adults see when it comes to bullying. But this can also relate to suicide, because youth often become more aware of their peers' social-emotional problems or early signs of mental health concerns than their parents or school staff. So this is very critical for us to involve youth and educate them about signs and symptoms that they might see in their peers and how to respond when they do. And this also relates to some of the works that summarized on cyberbullying, because youth are often more likely to be exposed to the information through social media sites. We also need to change some of the norms as it relates to how youth respond when they see these types of risks. If they become aware of a peer that might be at risk for involvement in bullying or might be at risk for involvement in suicide, that they need to reach out to adults and learn the difference between telling on someone or tattling on them, which is typically to get them in trouble, versus reporting to an adult, and this is a situation where they're trying to get help. And there can be a lot of stigma among kids about reaching out to adults for help because of concern that they might get someone in trouble or they themselves might get in trouble. So we need safe and structured manners for involving youth in reporting as well as activities that they can be involved in for prevention. And the next slide talks a little bit more about the role of technology. As I mentioned and was covered in the previous presentation, the role of cyberbullying. And I don't want to exaggerate the rates of cyberbullying because we know that youth that are involved in bullying are far more likely to be involved in more face-to-face contact rather than our social forms of bullying than they are in cyberbullying. But cyberbullying is certainly one area where we are seeing an increase in the forms of bullying. And it continues to expand as we move to other devices that are created as kids become very tech savvy and their knowledge of how to navigate this world outpaces their parents or the other adults in their environment. So we all need to be more knowledgeable about technology and how it can be used not only as a way of identifying youth who might be at risk for bullying or involved in bullying, but ways that we can reach out to youth who are at risk, and similarly youth that might be at risk for suicide. And adults need to supervise this cyber world and develop strategies, and there's some technologies that are being currently developed that can help with this, that will actually screen emails or screen postings and identify youth who might be at risk for suicide or those who are involved in bullying. And the technology piece can also be incorporated into screening, whether it be a web-based screening that's used in a school setting or other kinds of intervention or prevention approaches that tap into kids' emails or other instant message kinds of approaches. Then finally, I'm going to wrap up by just mentioning a couple of resources that are available. Certainly, our host for today's session, the Suicide Prevention Resource Center, has a lot of information on their website about best, including the Best Practices Registry for Suicide Prevention. The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention is another organization that has a lot of information. Did want to draw attention in particular to one element on their website, and I think SPRC also has a media guideline, but the one that's on the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention website I think is particularly helpful because it identifies what are some recommendations and non-recommended approaches for dealing with youth suicide or suicide more generally. And it seems that we seem to have forgotten a little bit about how to handle issues of suicide in the media when it comes to bullying-related suicides. So things like really being careful about how the information is shared and what kind of terms are used and a lot of details that might be provided. Those would be things that we want to really limit and limit exposure for youth that might be vulnerable because they could see those images or that could actually possibly increase their likelihood of committing suicide in a contagion type of manner. So we need to be careful and follow those media guidelines and think more closely about how those media guidelines related to suicide prevention also pertain to situations of bullying prevention and bullying-related suicides. And finally, there are a lot of resources that out there related to bullying prevention that I wanted to make you aware of. The stopbullying.gov is a great resource. There are a lot of tip sheets and other resources that have been put together. I know Sue Limber and her colleagues at HRSA had been involved in some of the early development of these materials, and they've since been moved over from Stop Bullying Now to stopbullying.gov as the main hub of bullying-related research and information and recommendations through the federal agencies. YouthFindInfo.gov is another great resource. This covers bullying as well as a broad set of youth-related issues, including some suicide information and other topics like health and nutrition. The National Registry of Evidence-Based Practices, or NREP, out of SAMHSA is a great resource, includes some information on bullying prevention, as does the Blueprints for Violence Prevention that's funded by Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention and is housed out of Colorado. So here are some references at the end that are available if you care to pull up a little bit more documentation regarding some of the research that was shared today. I'd be happy to take any questions that the audience might have.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bradshaw. I do note the time is 4:32, and wanted to encourage if anybody would like to stay on, we will continue having some question and answers. If you do need to step off the webinar, again, the slides are available on our website, and the audio recording will be available next week. However, at this time, we will take a few questions from the audience. And for Dr. Bradshaw, we wanted to know how effective are school bullying prevention policies? Is there any data, or do they improve the environment? Can you tell us a little bit more about all the bullying policies that are out there?
You know, there really hasn't been a lot of rigorous outcome-based research on policies. I think the U.S. Department of Ed is now engaged in some of that work, trying to document what impact these policies have had. So I think that's an area that's ripe for additional research. It's still on the list of recommended strategies because I think it's an important piece to be able to acknowledge the higher level involvement that's needed, that we need to have administrators aware of bullying and have procedures in place to be able to document it when it does happen. It also does provide an insurance in some way that there is going to be a more comprehensive approach. But the states do vary considerably in terms of the extent to which their policies adequately would address the issue of bullying. The state of New Jersey, which released their law this past September, I think early September it was released, and is one of the most rigorous anti-bullying policies that has been put out. So I think they cover a lot of core elements. Some might say that it's a little too rigorous in terms of the expectations on communities, but I think there is a great emphasis on evidence-based approaches. But there's a great need for technical assistance and support and even resources for schools and states to implement these kind of policies. Typically, they follow an unfunded mandate approach whereby the policy is rolled out, but there are not a lot of resources to implement them. So in addition, I think one factor that would influence the effectiveness of policies is the extent to which there are resources available to be able to implement them and the extent to which training is provided.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Bradshaw. And also for Dr. Cormack, if you could go ahead and unmute your line as well. Either of you can take this question. What are some of the early signs and symptoms of bullying behaviors in young children?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that. Could you repeat the question?
Sure. What are some of the early signs and symptoms of bullying behavior in young children?
Okay. I think for the bullying behavior, bullying others, I think we should be aware of kids who get into fights, to verbal fights, to physical fights, those who are having a hard time be empathic to others, having other friends which are bullies, more aggressive, impulsive, what Dr. Bradshaw referred to as having problems with emotion regulation and impulsivity. That would be for the bully part. For victimized, it could be from sadness, withdrawing, complaints of headaches, stomach aches, kids which are afraid to go to school, appear moody, angry, anxious, and really feel like something's going wrong and might even blame themselves for something's going wrong and don't want to go to school. A lot of these kids would not want to go to school or complain about what's going on in school. So we should really listen to these warning signs and take it seriously, both for the warning signs of the victims and of the bullies.
Yeah, just one thing I would add to that. I think that was a very comprehensive response. Just one piece that I'm kind of becoming more interested in is the role of siblings in this. We typically just think about bullying that happens within a peer relationship and doesn't include siblings. And while many schools are a little less interested in what's happening at the home, but I think we can see, especially in younger children, some early signs of bullying behavior that might be perpetrated by an older sibling to a younger one, or even cousins that might be spending a lot of time together. So that's another peer group or another group to keep your eye on where the bullying behavior might have an early onset. And that could lead to a just general pattern of aggressive behavior and problems resolving conflict successfully.
Thank you. And for Dr. Bradshaw, we have a couple of questions on law enforcement. How involved should law enforcement in the community, but also law enforcement officers in the schools, the school resource officers, how should they be involved in bullying prevention and intervention programs?
Well, I think the law enforcement officers, I've been working with some of them in Maryland, and they've just really been a great resource because they have a lot of knowledge about kids and what's going on, and they see a lot of things in the school. They're also very knowledgeable about rights and policies that are relevant for the school as well as in the community. I'm not advocating for a judicious response necessarily to bullying prevention, although there might be some situations that are pretty extreme where we might need to involve the law. But I think from a prevention angle that they can be critical in the implementation of policies and the implementation of programs.
Great, thank you. And we also wanted to know, do any of the programs that you mentioned get the parents more involved? Many of these problems need to be addressed, obviously, at home. And so wanted to know about the programs that have parental participation.
Yeah, that was actually one feature in the meta-analysis by David Farrington I had referenced, where that was a key component, is providing information to parents and having them be involved in the bullying prevention efforts. I know that's one element that the OVAIS bullying prevention program does provide, opportunities and a structure for families to become more knowledgeable about bullying prevention and to participate in bullying prevention activities, like be a member of the bullying prevention team. The Steps to Respect also does have a parent component. Many of them involve parents, especially at the indicated level where there are kids that are already involved in bullying and how the parents can be part of that therapeutic process. But I will acknowledge, I think that's one of the harder areas. I do a lot of school-based prevention, not just in bullying, but in violence prevention more generally, and getting parents, especially the parents of the higher-risk kids, to be involved and to be proactive in the school is very challenging, especially at the secondary level. You can get parent involvement usually pretty easily in the early elementary school grades, but somewhere around fourth and fifth grade, things tend to peter off a bit. And we're doing work now with the Coping Power program that I mentioned that is for higher-risk families that are already showing some signs of the child having bullying behavior and aggressive, disruptive behavior. And that's in Baltimore City, a very urban area, and it's been pretty challenging to get those parents to come to the sessions. So we've been doing some innovative approaches using motivational interviewing to try to engage the parents in the intervention and the prevention work. And really trying to reach out to those higher-risk families, the ones that really need the interventions the most.
Thank you. For Dr. Klomak, did your study take any macro-level phenomena into account, such as media, societal expectations, culture, into account when trying to explain bullying and its effects?
Unfortunately not, but I think it's a great point. I think that's one of the limitations of our studies and other studies that didn't take those into account, but should be. I think future studies should definitely take those perspectives, social, cultural, familial, into account.
All right, great. And for Dr. Bradshaw, can assemblies and one-day awareness events still be used in conjunction with other programs as part of the solution?
Yeah, I don't think that they, although it might vary a little bit on the content, you'd want to be careful about the content of the session. I don't think that they necessarily produce problematic outcomes, but it just when they're used in and of themselves and not connected up with a larger initiative, that I think that they may not be the best use of resources. And in terms of content, I just wanted to comment on this. You know, a lot of well-intended approaches might use some messages that are confusing for kids. Like there has been some interest lately in highlighting the bully suicide situation or cyber suicide situations and doing school presentations on that particular topic. And while it's important to raise awareness, we have to keep in mind that media education component as it relates to suicide, that we don't want to share content that might actually increase the likelihood of a suicide or potentially increase the likelihood of a bullying situation. So you have to think very carefully about what content is shared in those kinds of assemblies, just like we would think about what we would put on the newspaper or on the TV regarding a bullying suicide situation.
Great, thank you. And now, unfortunately, I think we are already over our time. And so I'd like to thank our presenters once again for sharing their insights and expertise. Thank you also for all of you who participated. You will be receiving an email in the next day or so requesting that you fill out a brief evaluation of this session. We hope you'll take a few short minutes to let us know how useful the webinar was for you. This concludes our webinar. Thank you and have a great rest of your week.